As we began forging a long-term bond, grounded in our working relationship and our shared affection for Texas, I didn't yet appreciate just how much that view would predominate, for better and worse, in Bush's approach to governing once he arrived in Washington. Then he mentioned some of his expectations for his spokespeople, the importance of staying on message, the need to talk about what you're for, rather than what you are against. How he liked to make the big news on his own time frame and terms without his spokespeople getting out in front of him. And finally, making sure that public statements were coordinated internally so that everyone is always on the same page and there are few surprises. I haven't made a decision about whether I will run for president, Bush added. I'm still thinking about it, but you have good political instincts, and I'll need your help watching out for me in this office if I start to test the ground. I told him I understood, and he wrapped up the conversation. We had clicked. I'd made no fatal mistakes. I was hired. Everything seemed pretty good to me at that moment. Here I was, joining the team of an accomplished leader with a proven ability to calm the partisan waters, bring people together, and achieve positive results. I had no reason to anticipate serious disappointment over the horizon. I was 30 years old at the time. Having grown up around politics on the local level in the capital city of Texas and having worked on the state level for nearly a decade, I knew politics often turns into a contact sport. Elections could be mean-spirited, but watching Washington during the 1990s was like watching the final weeks of a hotly contested political campaign that had turned wearily negative and was now being played out endlessly on television 24/7. Deliberation and compromise, elements central to governing, particularly in a constitutional representative democracy, all but disappeared. Who had the best ideas or policies mattered little compared to who was winning the battle for public opinion. Conflict, controversy, and negativity received growing emphasis in the media, and voices of partisanship and ideology grabbed increasingly more attention than voices of consensus and reason and pragmatism. As a Republican, I tended to view Democrats as more shrill and unfair in their tactics, but it was abundantly clear that both parties shared the blame for the deteriorating climate in Washington, where elections might be held, but the campaigning never stopped. The Clinton presidency had taken the art of successful campaigning to new, unparalleled levels. It had begun during the 1992 election, when the Clinton team, led by the colorful duo of George Stephanopoulos and James Carville, vowed not to allow their candidate to be mocked, belittled, and humiliated as Michael Dukakis had been in 1988. Campaigning with an effective aggressiveness shown by few Democrats in recent years, they captured the White House for their party for only the second time in 7 elections. Unfortunately, once inside the White House, the Clinton administration maintained much the same partisan, chip-on-the-shoulder posture, cynically employing spin, rapid response, obfuscation, dissembling, and bare-knuckle tactics to discredit those who challenged it openly. Meanwhile, Republicans in Congress, led by Newt Gingrich, stung by their loss of the presidency, responded in kind. They sought to wrest political power out of the president's hands by pushing an ideologically driven agenda, tearing down Clinton and attacking congressional Democrats rather than reaching out to forge common ways forward in line with their political priorities. Some of what the Gingrich Republicans did was simply smart political positioning, as when they developed and trumpeted their contract with America as a coherent agenda and set of shared talking points for congressional candidates to rally around. The gambit helped them wrest control of the House of Representatives from the Democrats in 1994. But some of what they did was based on exaggerated charges of dishonesty, immorality, and corruption, using Washington's scandal culture as a weapon to attack Clinton and his allies. The parade of scandals seemed endless. Travelgate, Whitewater, FBI Gate, the Vince Foster case, the Rose Law Firm billing records affair, and of course, the Monica Lewinsky episode. In the eyes of history, some of these scandals will probably seem insignificant, others disturbing, but less than earth-shattering. But their effect on politics in the 1990s is indisputable. Zero-sum politics became the rule. There could be only winners and losers. For the media, it was all about who was up and who was down. For elected leaders, the truth behind the storyline mattered less than being on the offensive, shaping the narrative to your political advantage with the American people, or defensively responding to it. And as I think this book will show, there's a direct line between the attitude that truth is secondary to political victory and the obfuscation, dissembling, and lack of intellectual honesty that helped take our country into the war in Iraq. But in Texas during the 1990s, something different was going on. A popular Republican governor is working closely with a Democratic lieutenant governor and a Democratic Speaker of the House to produce legislation and policies that met the needs and satisfied the desires of the majority of the state's people, whether conservative or liberal. In large part because of Democratic Lieutenant Governor Bob Bullock's influence and Bush's keen grasp of Texas politics, there was little animosity between the leaders of the executive and legislative branches of government. It was not about who received credit for the results. Playing politics during the legislative session was viewed as unacceptable and was not tolerated. Governing was less about persuading or selling the public and more about deliberating and compromising to serve the best interest of Texas. Most state leaders believed they had been elected to do that, and they worked to uphold their end of the bargain. As soon as he was elected governor, Bush reached out to Democratic leaders, including the powerful Bullock, hoping to govern in a bipartisan manner. In Texas, the governor and lieutenant governor are elected separately. Bullock had deep roots in Texas government, having previously served four terms as the influential Texas comptroller. The Texas Constitution placed great power in the lieutenant governor as head of the Texas Senate, where he appointed committee chairpersons and determined the flow of legislation, directly influencing whether bills were passed or killed. Bullock's forceful personality, as large as Texas, made him even more effective than the average lieutenant governor. For all these reasons, Bush knew that building trust and a close relationship with Bullock, as well as with the Democratic Speaker, Pete Laney, would be integral to getting his priorities passed. The three spoke frequently and met routinely at least once a week during session. By all accounts, Bush established far more collegial relations with Bullock and Laney than his Democratic predecessor, Ann Richards, had done. Bush also reached out and built relationships with other Democratic leaders in the legislature, particularly, but not exclusively, key committee chairs. It was not unusual for Bush to stop by a member's office unannounced for a visit, and when election time came, Bush did not campaign against incumbent Democratic leaders who worked with him and helped advance his priorities. This nonpartisan approach paid real dividends. During his first session, Bush managed to pass the largest revision of the state's education code in decades, strengthen juvenile justice laws, and implement reforms in regard to both welfare and lawsuits, core issues during his campaign for governor. To me, leadership means uniting people around a common purpose rather than dividing them along ideological lines, and I found Governor Bush's leadership inspiring. He adroitly joined forces with Bullock and Laney to build and sustain a strongly bipartisan, collegial approach to governing. Could his leadership usher in a new political dynamic on the national level too, as it had in Texas? Many younger people were looking for just such a change. After all, shouldn't politics be about something higher and better than what our leaders in Washington were delivering? With the right presidential leadership, couldn't our elected leaders learn to set aside the excesses of perpetual campaigning and scorched earth politics and work together to serve our nation's best interest? Like many other Americans, I believe they could. I always viewed politics as a way to make a positive difference for the common good, a belief that had been instilled in me early in life. It was for that reason, as much as any other, that I chose a career in the field. And George W. Bush, I genuinely believed, just might embody what I and so many others were seeking, a leader who could make us believe that it would be worthwhile to go to Washington after all, to see if we could change the destructive dynamic that dominated it during the 1990s. As governor, Bush focused on big issues with broad appeal that affected all Texans. When it came to controversial issues like abortion, for example, he sought to find common ground by identifying practical ways to reduce the number of abortions, such as supporting parental notification and promoting adoption. He did not expend effort on divisive, narrow issues, tailor his words to please a particular group of people, or strive to pit groups of people against one another for political gain. His popularity in Texas spanned the spectrum of Democrats, Independents, and Republicans. With an approval rating reaching well into the 70s, Bush attracted broad support for his leadership, policies, and governance. It was a solid record of bipartisan accomplishment that he would highlight during his presidential campaign. Our campaign slogans captured what was unique about Bush. He was a uniter, not a divider, a different kind of Republican from the hard-edged, confrontational Gingrich and his group. He offered a compassionate conservative agenda and a commitment to change the bitter tone in Washington by bringing Republicans and Democrats together to solve the big problems. Bush's principled leadership, bipartisan record, and compassionate conservative agenda inspired much hope in me and those whom I would soon call colleagues, fellow members of the Bush team. And that's why I was there, seizing a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be part of something grand, because I believe that politics could be something far better than politics as usual. No wonder I was both thrilled and humbled at being hired to work for George W. Bush.